Aston, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences here at the University of Tennessee. It gives me great pleasure to welcome the Reverend Dr. Lloyd to our campus this evening, but my job this evening is to introduce a friend of mine who will introduce in turn the main speaker and other guests, Professor George Conner. In my first months here, I heard the name George Conner frequently and asked who this man might be. And I was told that he was an eminent professor of English, now retired, and a famous Episcopalian. But I still ask, and finally one of his colleagues said, well, let me explain it to you this way, Dean. He is the dean of our faculty emeritus. I didn't know exactly what he meant then, but after 4 years in Chattanooga, I sure know now what he meant. I give to you Professor George Conner.
Thank you. It's sad to realize that I'm out of Dean Gaston's reach for salary raises and things of that sort. And even sadder to realize that we don't have this on tape, but maybe we do. Before I introduce him, I do want to acknowledge the presence of a person very important to this enterprise. The prime mover in the C.S. Lewis lecture series was the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. The first director who was involved was Charles Hummel, who did the Lewis lecture a year ago, and he has been succeeded by Terry Morrison, whom we are also delighted to have. Now it is my pleasure, on behalf of the Planning Committee, the Moccasin Christian Fellowship, the chief sponsor, and the various co-sponsors, to present the 10th lecturer in the C.S. Lewis lecture series. Our guest speaker this evening is Dr. Samuel T. Lloyd III, University Chaplain at the University of the South at Sewanee. As the University Chaplain, Dr. Lloyd has a ministry including the college, the seminary, and the larger university community. He is a frequent speaker and conference leader for reasons that will be apparent to you almost immediately. A native of Mississippi, Dr. Lloyd earned the Ph.D. in English at the University of Virginia. His dissertation dealt with the poetry of Robert Penn Warren. His Master of Divinity degree is from Virginia Theological Seminary. Immediately before his coming to Sewanee, almost precisely 4 years ago, Dr. Lloyd was rector of a parish in Chicago, where he also taught the preaching courses at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Earlier, he was on the religion faculty at the University of Virginia and served there on the staff of St. Paul's Memorial Church. In his autobiographical book, The Seven-Story Mountain, the Trappist monk Thomas Merton wrote about his years at Columbia University as follows. Strangely enough, it was on this big factory of a campus that the Holy Ghost was waiting to show me the light in his own light. And one of the chief means he used and through which he operated was human friendship. God has willed that we should all depend on one another for our salvation, and all strive together for our own mutual good and our common salvation. End of quote. And one of the most important persons for Thomas Merton in that circle of friends was that distinguished teacher and poet and critic, Mark Van Doren. I've never sat in one of Dr. Lloyd's classes, but I know the marks of greatness in a teacher, and I am perfectly certain that he will figure also in autobiographies, written or unwritten, in the same way that Mark Van Doren has. I hope it is not too personal to add that Sam Lloyd has been in my prayers from the first day I met him, as I hope I'm sometimes in his. My admiration for him is virtually without limit, and I take it as a great honor to present him to you to speak on the subject, How Can We Know the Struggle of Faith Until We Have Faces? Dr. Lloyd.
I want to thank George for that wonderful introduction. I hope I can live up to a piece of that. The problem, however, is that he said that and then left the stage. He's not going to be here, and neither is Paul to deal with what follows. So they're clean, and you're left with me. I also want to say that I can't see you out there. So if some of you are leaving to go watch the basketball game in a little while, just try to do it quietly. I was saying to someone a little while ago that it's pretty tough for Duke and Michigan to have to deal with each other. I have to take them both on tonight. So we'll all do the best we can with that. Swanee is a small little college up on a mountaintop. Some of you may have heard of along the way. An Episcopal institution. It also is a school I find that a great many people don't know too much about. I was talking to someone earlier today who asked me how many people are studying at Swanee, and that reminded me of the time that Pope John Paul II was asked how many people are working at the Vatican, and he said about half. That's probably a pretty good guess for Swanee, too. Tonight we're going to talk about what is my favorite work of C.S. Lewis's and the one that many people think is his best. We're going to deal with one particular and I think crucial part of that book that points to one particular and I think essential part of the whole struggle of faith, the whole effort to try to make sense of ourselves and of the one we seek whom we call God. I've entitled the evening's talk, How Can We Know? Because it seems to me something I find again and again in the work in my work as a college chaplain, as well as in my work as a parish priest before, is people wanting to know about God's reality and presence and purpose. I find it particularly among those, as I move around a college campus, trying to figure out just whether God exists or not at all. And part of the poignancy that comes again and again for people who are trying to figure out where God is and if there is a God, is their simple desire for God to be known, for God to be palpable and clear, for us to experience Him, hear Him, touch Him in one way or another. The most poignant way I know that gets expressed is in a marvelous movie by Woody Allen called Love and Death, where the character Woody Allen is playing cries out desperately for God to become known, saying, "Give me an answer, God, are you there?" Dead silence. Just a few words. Dead silence. At least a cough. And of course, dead silence. Well, it's that dilemma of wanting to know God and finding only perplexity and ambiguity and even silence. That's very much what I think Till We Have Faces is all about. But it also has resonances, I think, and implications for people involved in the life of faith well along in their journey who, again, come up against a God who all of a sudden isn't clear, a God who isn't real in prayer for some reason or another, a God whom we ask to lead us, but whose leading isn't manifest. A God whom we ask to help us, but whose help seems far away. And certainly we know of this struggle to find God when we encounter suffering or pain or loss. How can we know about God? How can we know who we are in the eyes of God? That's exactly, I think, what C.S. Lewis was writing this book to grapple with. You may know that Till We Have Faces, Lewis wrote near the end of his life, in the last decade or so of his life, after quite a remarkable career as an apologist, someone who presented the case for Christianity. And compared to so many of the other things he wrote, this book is strikingly different. You know, if you've read Mere Christianity, you follow powerful, logical arguments that almost require at the end of them, or so it would seem, our assent to Christian belief. Lewis has a powerful, logical mind at work in the problem of pain and in the book Miracles. And in fact, he says at one place there, "I am not asking anyone to accept Christianity if his best reasoning tells him that the weight of the evidence is against it. A sane man accepts or rejects any statement not because he wants or does not want to, but because the evidence seems to him good or bad. If he thought the evidence bad but tried to force himself to believe in spite of it, that would be merely stupid." Well, I think a lot of the attraction of Lewis's writing along the way has been that absolute commitment to reason, to making the case, to a kind of sunny, upbeat confidence that Christianity can be proved. You see that in his space fiction as well, where along with being vivid evocations of other planets and other places, he's always making a logical, theological argument that he expects us to follow with him and agree to. But it doesn't always turn out quite so clearly. One of the things that we find as we move on in Lewis's work is that commitment to clarity, the logical argument begins to weaken a little bit. Even if you see it in the Chronicles of Narnia with the allegory, it begins to break down after a while. Lewis, in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, talks about combining in his own work, in his own life, two distinct parts of his personality. He was a powerful rationalist. Reason can argue is the essential way to understanding the way the world works. Argument by reason is the way by which we know the way the world works. But at the same time, he describes himself as a deeply felt romantic, someone for whom the Norse myths, the ancient stories, became the most powerful instruments for his own ultimate conversion. So a lot of his own autobiography talks about these two pieces of his mind at work, the rationalist side and the romantic side. But clearly what seemed to weigh out most heavily was this lucid, rational presentation of Christianity. At the same time, he kept himself out of his writing for a long time. Certainly in Mere Christianity, in those books, we don't get much picture of Lewis, the human being, at work very much. His stories are told in the third person. Time and again, we find that it is that absolute clarity being presented out there that matters. But something began to happen in the late 40s and early 50s. Some have suggested that it was a result of Lewis being absolutely whipped in a debate with the philosopher G.E.M. Anscombe, in which Lewis had presented his rigorous, rational arguments and found a brilliant philosopher taking them apart. He felt he'd been defeated by that, and it seems to have wounded him pretty severely. It may also have something to do with his deep love for Joy Davidman that took shape in the 1950s as well. A return to being more in touch with the wellsprings of his own feeling, of his own passion. That whole experience seems to have shattered a lot of his own assurances about how we know and what we know, and how life is to work in an orderly and clear way. The effect of all that has been, at least as we see it Until We Have Faces, that we have a fresh, freer, more personal, ultimately, I think, more self-revealing exploration of the nature of life, of the nature of love, and finally, of the nature of God. I'm going to take us into this novel now, spending a little time developing the plot and then leading you all into what I think are the great issues he unfolds. And I hope as I do, you all will remember what questions occur to you as we go along, because I'm promised we'll have some conversation when all this is over and I can find out some of what you've thought about this or what your thoughts are on some of the issues that C.S. Lewis is dealing with and with which I'm grappling. But you got to do some work by following this plot carefully. It twists around a pretty good bit, but if you stay with me, I think you can do it. So let's try. It goes like this. A king once upon a time had, of course, three daughters, of whom, of course, the youngest was beautiful. So beautiful that she was worshipped as a goddess. Her name was Psyche. And so beautiful, too, that the great goddess Venus was in a jealous rage about this beautiful mortal. Because of her beauty, Psyche had no suitors. No one would come to her. They didn't feel worthy. And the oracle of Apollo told her father that he would have no son-in-law at all, that in fact he must get rid of Psyche. She's too beautiful. The gods are too jealous of her. In the meantime, Venus sent her son Cupid to afflict Psyche with love for the basest of human beings. But Cupid fell in love with Psyche. And he had the west wind come and sweep her up and carry her away to a secret palace where Cupid would come and visit her under cover of night and make love to her. And they thrived in a relationship of delightful happiness. Psyche, though, missed her sisters. And she finally convinced Cupid to let them come visit. And they came and feasted and expressed great delight at what had happened to Psyche. But they became jealous and plotted to destroy her happiness. They convinced Psyche that, in fact, this great god of love who came to her under cover of night was no wonderful god at all, but a monstrous serpent, and that she, for her own good, needed to light a lamp to see just who this god is who was coming. And once she did, she saw this glorious god, fell madly in love with him. But one drop of oil from the lamp fell on Cupid, woke him, and she was banished from his sight, and he fled away. And Psyche was sent to wander, wretched and desolate, banned forever from the presence of the gods. In her wandering, though, she fell into the hands of her bitter enemy, Venus. And the goddess gave her four impossible tasks, saying, if you can do those four impossible things, maybe you can undo what you've done. So the tasks were tasks of sorting seeds and gathering wool from man-eating sheep and collecting sacred water from the river Styx and going down into the underworld to fetch back a box of Persephone's beauty. She receives help in accomplishing these tasks. But for the last, she goes it alone to the underworld, and on the way back, carrying the box of Persephone's beauty, which she's been ordered never to open at cost of her life, she takes one little peek and is again banished away. Only this time, finally, Cupid does rescue her, brings her back. Jupiter forgives her. Her case is pled before the highest court, and she is finally forgiven and allowed to marry Cupid. Got all that? It's essentially, you can see, a story of a beautiful mortal falling in love with a god, and how that god comes to her when she can't see him, can't know fully who he is, and how Psyche thrives with that love until she doesn't trust it and has to see for herself. And when she does, the love collapses. The god vanishes. And she must go on a long quest to find God again. There's a long tradition in the interpretation of this myth in seeing it as a story about the relationship between human beings and God. We who can't see God, who yet may know God's grace, God's love, God's intimacy. And yet when we go about trying to prove it, to define it, to contain it, it flees away. And we find ourselves off on a long quest to find it again. Lewis, when he took this myth, made two crucial changes in the story. First of all, he told the story from the point of view, not of Psyche, but from the point of view of one of the jealous sisters, a young woman named Arule. And Arule is really the one the story is about. She's the key figure, the one through whom we see what Lewis is saying about the life of faith. The other change he made seems pretty subtle, but actually was crucial. In the scene when Arule visits Psyche in the grand palace of the gods, it's so that Lewis changes the story so that Arule, when Arule comes to see Psyche, can't see the palace at all. She sees none of that grand home in which Psyche is dwelling. For her, Psyche seems simply to be living out in the wilderness. So what he's done in making this, as he meant to, a very modern story, is saying that Arule, who's going to be you and me, who's going to be our embodiment in the story, is someone who, when going to find God, can't see at all and wants to know where this God's house is. Where is this God's home? How can I know this God? And Arule will leave there convinced there is no God at all. Are there gods or not? If so, can we see them? What would it mean for us to see them? By changing that one detail so that Arule can't see what Psyche sees, he makes it a very modern story of the struggle for faith. Well, let's begin. The story is in two parts. The first part is called The Accusation of the Gods. And in the course of it, we find Arule telling us how rough her life has been and drawing us in to sympathy with the struggle she's gone through. This whole part is an exploration of faith and doubt, of reason and imagination, an exploration about how we see the world, about the nature of the self, and the tangled web of human motivation. It's all set in what's called a literal little barbarous state called Gloam, which is a small little nation somewhere in the Near East that centers its life on a fertility goddess, someone named Unget. It's placed at just the time when Greek rationalism and the fertility cults were beginning to intersect with each other, and the event of the incarnation of Christ still lay in the future. Arule is telling us time and again through this whole first part about how unfairly the gods, and particularly the god Unget, have treated her all along. It is her simple set of accusations. Part two will overturn completely the way the story works, but let's stay with part one. I will accuse the gods, she says, and she does it time and again, expressing her anger at the way the gods have treated her. There is this Unget who demands fertility rights, who demands crops, who demands service so that the crops will grow, who demands animal sacrifice. And a lot of the tension of the story is our trying to come to terms with the rule, with whether this religion of Unget is true, or whether that, like most religion, is some kind of superstition human beings have cooked up. What becomes immediately clear as we follow the story is that there are two conflicting worldviews at work: the vision of the priest of the goddess Unget and the people who follow the people of Gloam, and as we'll see, a rationalist who says this is all a lot of bunk, who says that really all religion is mere superstition. The religion of Gloam works in some fairly peculiar ways. In order to keep from having this goddess Unget devour them or kill them by drought, they have to go through a series of rituals, sacrifices, rites, time and again. Occasionally, Gloam goes through famine and pestilence and drought. And then the priest of Unget comes to declare that the land is impure and Unget is unhappy and something must be done. You almost can smell in the story the burning animal sacrifice, the smoke rising of the incense, the expression of a religion of ritual trying to tap in to the power at the heart of religion to appease gods who are against us, so we human beings can live. Part of it is when someone is sacrificed. Human sacrifices happen again and again. And when that happens, a victim is led up the mountain to a holy tree and tied to the tree and left. And then the brute comes and devours the one tied to the tree. Then let me read you a description of what happens in the course of this sacrifice. A victim offered, here we go, is said to be Unget's husband, and a woman is said to be the bride of Unget's son, and both are called a brute's supper. And when the brute is Unget, it lies with the man, and when it is her son, it lies with the woman. And either way, there is a devouring. Some say the loving and devouring are all the same. If you're confused by that, you're supposed to be. It's people probing, what's going on? How can we appease the powers at the heart of life? How can we make them be for us? How can we shape them and control them? The king and his advisors are very confused by all this and doubt it. But the priest presses home his case. I, king, have dealt with the gods for three generations of men. And I know that they dazzle our eyes and flow in and out of one another like eddies on a river. And nothing that is said clearly can be said truly about them. Holy places are dark places. It is life and strength, not knowledge and words that we get in them. Holy wisdom is not clear and thin like water, but thick and dark like blood. So the divine reality we're all dealing with by this view is something powerful that shapes our life and yet is elusive. Something that needs to be appeased. Something we don't get clear ideas about or clear knowledge about. But something that is terrifying that we have to figure out how to come to terms with if we're going to live at all. Holy places are dark and mysterious places. But there's another view, that of someone called the fox, who is a Greek slave captured, who is there in the court of the king and ends up being Orul's tutor. And for the fox, that is all a lot of foolishness. Of course, nature works by natural explanations. Of course, the natural flow of things can be understood. Of course, all we can do is simply accept our place in the rhythm of things, and anything else is sheer superstition and foolishness. The gods, he says, are all folly and lies of poets. And in response to the priest's call for a sacrifice to the brute, he blurts out to the king, "Do you not see, master, that the priest is talking nonsense? A shadow is to be an animal, which is also a goddess, which is also a god, and loving is to be eating? A child of six could talk more sense." The fox knows how to think logically. Wind and weather are part of the same web. It's all called nature. It is all one whole. When we die, we go back to the elements. It is foolish to think about life as involving any more than that at all. Well, the fox is Arul's revered teacher, and through him she learns this rationality and this skepticism. Always he assumes there's a reasonable explanation for whatever happens. And what we find as we move through this whole first part is that we're getting caught up ourselves. So which is true? That view of Ungot, that religion of Ungot, can't quite be true, can it? And yet isn't the fox leaving something out? How do you know? And most of all, won't the gods make themselves clear for all of us to see? Well, a lot of the substance of the accusation that Arul is making involves sifting through these two worldviews. We watch her resentment and her anger unfold in the course of the story as we watch her watch Psyche blossom into this beautiful, radiant young woman. Psyche is so loving at all times, so beautiful that people come to her just to be touched by her. And often when she touches them, they're healed. And Psyche, who happens to be left to the side of all this, quietly to herself, it seems, begins to simmer some. She's being left out. But there's also something else. Early on, we discover that Psyche, that Arul is created to be happens to be physically very ugly. Her father calls her Goblin Face. And through that whole first part, she comes more and more to be aware that she is an odd, ugly duckling left out of the picture. So there she is on the side, watching Psyche get all the attention, get all the radiant affection of the people, the delight of her father, until the time comes when the father demands that she be taken out as a sacrifice to end the drought in Gloam. Once the father is convinced that Psyche has to be sacrificed, though, Arul resists it, because Arul and Psyche have become very close. Psyche's sweet, gentle love has embraced Arul. And now Arul is horrified that she will lose this, her beautiful friend. Arul comes to feel cheated, and she invites you into feeling cheated with her as you read the story. You come to realize, though, that what she's cheated about is not that Psyche is going to be put to death, but that she, Arul, is going to lose her best friend. Psyche is taken up to be sacrificed, just the way the myth tells the story. And as Lewis tells this part, we watch step by step unfolding the great climactic scene. Psyche's taken up there, she's left, presumably the sacrifice happens, and then Arul begins to insist that she be allowed to go up and find her sister and see what's happened to her. She's convinced by now that either the monster has completely destroyed her or has left her there desolate. And so Arul presses the case to go and find Psyche and see what's going on. And when she goes up to find her, this great scene unfolds. Because she finds not some decimated, miserable, brutally treated creature, but Psyche, beautiful and happy, living there in the mountains. Arul doesn't know what to make of it. Psyche tells the story of the god coming to her at night, making love to her at night, and the delight they have in their life together. And Arul is horrified by it. If this is all true, she says, I've been wrong all my life. Everything has to be begun over again. Her whole involvement in the fox's skepticism, her whole commitment to only believing what you can touch and feel, is being challenged by her own sister, who says there is a love that comes that you can't see, that comes to me under cover of night and makes me filled with joy. And yet, I can't prove it to you at all. When Arul asked to be shown the palace that Psyche says she's living in, Psyche says, "Look, it's all around you." And Arul can't see it anywhere. Arul cries out, "Stop it! Stop it at once! There's nothing there! You're pretending! You're trying to make yourself believe it!" Psyche had given Arul wine in a goblet. Arul says, "No, you gave me no wine in a goblet. It was water in my hand." And then she says, "And what of this God that comes? Where is this God? Where is this palace?" "Nowhere, but in your fancy." And Psyche has to say, "I've never seen him. He comes to me only under cover of darkness." Arul can't deny how beautiful and alive Psyche is. She can't deny what's become of Psyche. But she pleads with Psyche to let go of this, to leave it behind, to reject it as an illusion and come back to reality. C.S. Lewis once described this novel as, and I'm quoting him, "the story of every nice, affectionate agnostic whose dearest one suddenly gets religion, or even every lukewarm Christian whose dearest gets a vocation." So here we get the fundamental issue in the first part of the novel. One view of things which claims with joy and confidence and deeply felt experience the power and nurture of the gods that can fill our lives. And another view that stands outside faith, skeptical, seeing nothing, and protesting at the naivete and unreality of the believer's point of view. Each view seems closed to the other. Each emphasizes how hard it is to see God, to know God. For the fox, in his view, seeing is a matter of receiving sense impressions. For the religion of Ungud and Psyche, there's another kind of seeing, a seeing deeply into things, a way of participation as a kind of knowing that Fox has no notion of at all. There's one little catch, though, in Arul's accusation, her cry against the gods for sending Psyche away, for her own ugliness, for the ways she's been treated, and now for the ways the gods have ruined Psyche's own life. There's one little twist. Just when Arul is leaving that confrontation up there with Psyche to go back, she looks back across the valley just for a minute. And for a moment, she sees the palace. Just for a moment before it's covered with clouds. There it was. For a moment, Psyche's faith became evident to Arul, but then it vanished. And this leads Arul to summarize her case against the gods. "That moment when I saw the house, does it tell against the gods or against me? What is the use of a sign which is itself only another riddle? The gods set the riddle and then allow a seeming that can't be tested and can only quicken and thicken the tormenting whirlpool of our guesswork. If they had an honest intention to guide us, why is their guidance not plain? Why can't the gods be clear? Why can't all come to us in clear reason and sense impressions? Why this elusiveness?" The problem of understanding what's going on continues as Arul goes back to the palace, finds there her old friend Bardia, who's very much part of the religion of Ungud, who is convinced that everything that has happened according to the religion is true, finding there also the fox who says it's all foolishness. Bardia's theory, on the one hand, is that Psyche actually is with a god, but that God may be a destructive God. Fox's view is that there's a runaway man up there who's got Psyche in such a state of terror that she doesn't know what's going on, which is correct. How do you know? And from that crux, the rest of part one works its way out. Arul goes back to Psyche one more time and persuades her, we might even say forces her, finally, to light a lamp to see who this God is. And Psyche, who doesn't want to do it, is so afraid, finally, for Arul's own well-being that she agrees to do it. And, of course, when Psyche does, Cupid wakes. Psyche goes into exile. Arul flees back home. And all seems to be in a state of terrible disaster. Then the story unfolds very rapidly. Arul, fairly quickly, her father dies. Arul becomes the queen of the realm, puts a veil on, which she wears pretty much the rest of her life, and proceeds in rapid order to become a shrewd, wise, and very strong ruler of the nation of Glom. But late in her career as queen, Arul is on a trip to another land, and she hears of all things what's now become a sacred story, the telling of what happened with Psyche and this god Cupid. Only this time, when she hears it, all the ambiguity about the reality of the palace is left out. In this version, Psyche's sisters were jealous, and they clearly saw the palace, and that enrages Arul. Hearing all this brings back to life Arul's long-standing rage and resentment that she had suppressed for a long time. Her fury at the gods for all that has happened to Psyche, and for all the gods' elusiveness. So she decides to write down her account of everything that the gods have done cruelly toward her. And that is what we're reading in part one. And she summarizes it this way. Now you who read, judge between the gods and me. They gave me nothing in the world to love but Psyche and then took her from me. They would not tell me whether she was the bride of a god, or mad, or a brute's or villain spoil. They would give no clear sign, though I begged for it. I say the gods deal very unrightly with us. For they will neither, which would be best of all, go away and leave us to live our short days to ourselves, nor will they show themselves openly and tell us what they would have us to do. For that too would be endurable. But to hint and hover, to draw near us in dreams and oracles, or in a waking vision that vanishes as soon as seen, to be dead silent when we question, and then glide back and whisper words we cannot understand in our ears, when we most wish to be free of them, and to show to one what they hide from another. What is all this but cat and mouse play? Blind man's buff and mere jugglery. Why must holy places be dark places? It's a demand for a reply, an explanation for the mysterious ways our lives work, for the things that don't come out even, for the suffering we go through. For whatever it may be, the physical ugliness, the family that doesn't work, the relationships that collapse, the never finding the one we thought we would find to spend our lives with, for the suffering and loss of those we love, why must holy places be dark places? We deserve an explanation. Why is the presence of the Holy One we call God so elusive, so hard to grasp and know? Why is talk of religious experience often so confusing? Why can't one person duplicate what happens to another? Why can't God be clear for all to see? Why do the sacred stories, like the stories in the Bible, make the presence of the Lord so obvious, the Lord's intention so clear? And yet when we seek them for ourselves, we often find them so elusive, so hard to find and know. Here at the end, or near the end of Lewis's life, Lewis seems to have been able to express real sympathy for the dilemma of the searcher, the one trying to know God, even for the agnostic. He seems to have recognized the elusiveness and difficulty and mystery of faith, and that sheer rational argument can't resolve the matter. In fact, he begins to hint, deep personal transformation will have to happen if someone is going to see God. Holy places seem to be dark places. Part two is a much briefer part. Has led us into in part one. If we can call part one Arul's self-justification and her accusation, part two is her confrontation with the truth of herself, her own self-revelation and confession. And I might add, I often come back to the story in one way or another during the season of Lent, because it is powerfully at this point a story of the ways we deceive ourselves and the surprise that comes when we begin to see truthfully who we are and what we really are working on and seeking for our lives. C.S. Lewis wrote a poem at about the time he wrote Till We Have Faces that captures very much what I think happens in part two, which is an experience of a kind of sudden surprise when we're forced to reevaluate everything our lives have been about and the kind of assumptions, the kind of pride, the kind of clear sense of ourselves we set out with all of a sudden gets blown apart and we have to rethink things. I want to read you this poem. In the case of this poem, Lewis is writing about what the experience of falling in love has done for him and how it has forced him to review the whole way he's thought about himself. It goes like this. All this is flashy rhetoric about loving you. I never had a selfless thought since I was born. I am mercenary and self-seeking through and through. I want God, you, all friends, merely to serve my turn. Peace, reassurance, pleasure are the goals I seek. I cannot crawl one inch outside my proper skin. I talk of love. A scholar's parrot may talk Greek, but self-imprisoned always end where I begin. Only that now you have taught me but how late my lack. I see the chasm, and everything you are was making my heart into a bridge by which I might get back from exile and grow man. And now the bridge is breaking. For this I bless you as the ruin falls. The pains you give me are more precious than all other gains. His wife was dying as he wrote that, and it expresses his profound discovery of how self-deceived his whole life had been. And bear in mind, this is being written by the man who was, by most accounts, the most famous, distinguished Christian in Christendom, saying, I never had a selfless thought since I was born. Well, that's the discovery that Arul enters into in this last part. In a series of rapidly unfolding events, She is forced to confront herself and all that she has been for the first time. A rule you may remember I mentioned, soon after she becomes queen, puts on a veil and never takes it off again, and that becomes a kind of symbol for what her whole life is. She presents a vigorous, confident self to the world. Ultimately, in fact, coming to believe that vigorous, self-confident self, and masking even from herself the ugliness that's hidden. The veil becomes a symbol for all that Orul has been hiding from herself and from others. And it starts being pulled away. The first thing that happens is she discovers that her very troubled sister Redival, the third sister, who had gone from one problem to another, had suffered all of their growing up because Orul had shifted all of her attention to Psyche. Orul had spent all of that time feeling sorry for herself and completely ignored Redival. And now she realizes that Redival felt completely rejected by her sister. Then she discovers that the wife of Bardia, who had become her chief minister and helper, had resented all their years the way Orul would devise ways to keep Bardia there at work, not let him go home because she needed companionship. Orul discovers that in every relationship she had been involved in, she had been possessive, domineering, self-pitying, and manipulative. Bardia's wife says, "You're full-fed, gorged with other men's lives, women's too." And Orul can only admit now the truth as what come to be called the divine surgeons go to work to probe and reveal even to herself the person she'd been all those years and never faced for herself. There's one particularly vivid dream sequence. A lot of this starts happening in dream sequences. When Orul finds herself in the chamber room, the throne room, and in this dream her father, long dead, comes up, hands her a pickaxe and tells her to start digging down through the floor. So she digs down through the floor until a great opening develops, and they go down through it to another throne room beneath. He tells her to dig again, and she digs again down to another throne room, and then down to another below that until they're in a dark image of the throne room from which they started. And then the father takes her and walks her over to a mirror and has her look in the mirror. And she looks at herself, and what she sees is Unget, the devouring, vicious goddess. It's clearly a journey into her own inner life, into her own inner world. And what she finds at the heart of who she is the very devouring goddess whom they fear in terror living around them. Finally, she has to face the cruel possessiveness that has been working at every step of the story. Only in part one, she had us on her side. Part of the powers of reading this through is she has you with her. And now we see how easily we, like she, were deceived. Another series of dream visions follow that culminate with Orul reading out the expression of her life, summarizing what her life has become, all the anger and self-pity and possessiveness, as she again accuses the gods, this time caught, and now in fury at the self-revelation that has so convicted her. "To steal her love from me," she says to the gods, "to make her see things I couldn't see. Oh, you'll say, you've been whispering it to me these 40 years, that I'd had signs enough her palace was real, could have known the truth if I'd wanted. But how could I want to know the truth? Tell me that. The girl was mine. What right had you to steal her away into your dreadful heights? You'll say I was jealous. Jealous of Psyche? Not while she was mine. I was my own, and Psyche was mine, and no one else had any right to her. Oh, you'll say you took her away into bliss and joy such as I could never have given her, and I ought to have been glad of it for her sake. Why? What should I care for some horrible new happiness which I hadn't given her and which separated her from me? Do you think I wanted her to be happy that way? Did you ever remember whose that girl was? She was mine. Mine. Do you know what that word means? Mine. And Arul comes to realize that she's been reading that set of words to the gods dozens of times, as if that's been the deep inner truth she's been saying to the gods all her life. And then, with the truth of her life now laid bare, she's asked in this great visionary moment if her complaint has been answered, the complaint of a lifetime. And she says, yes. Then she says, the complaint was the answer. To have heard myself making it was to be answered. She's finally confronted the harsh truth of her life she spent all of her life running away from. The way she has manipulated those around her, the way she's avoided the truth about herself, the way she has tried in every way possible to promote herself at the expense of others. And then her confrontation with herself is summarized in what seemed to me the novel's climactic words. When the time comes to you at which you will be forced at last to utter the speech which has lain at the center of your soul for years, which you have all that time, idiot-like, been saying over and over, you'll not talk about joy of words. I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly, nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? Seeing the gods is impossible as long as we ourselves are mired in illusion. And illusion seems to be the inescapable condition of our lives. Mystics of the Christian faith have for centuries talked about this constant human process of creating illusory images of God and of ourselves. And the great teachers of our whole Western tradition, all the way back from St. Paul to Plato, to John of the Cross, to even someone like Freud in our century, all are so profoundly aware of how difficult it is to know the truth of anything, how quick we are to create illusions for ourselves, for our God, and for those around us. The difficulty in knowing God is that we take so little of the truth of ourselves into the encounter so often. And the process of coming to know God requires what another Englishman, T.S. Eliot, called a lifetime's death in love, observance, discipline, thought, and action. We can never finally have a truthful face in this life. We can never fully know God. But all of our life will be a process of knowing ourselves more truly and our God more fully as our awareness of ourselves and our world and our God grow. There is one finale, quick finale to this story. It doesn't end with the rule's painful confrontation with herself, though I think that's the climax of the journey. But very quickly, and I think kind of confusingly at the end, Lewis tells the story of O'Rourke's final healing herself. The process of the divine surgery she has entered into forces her to accept the reality that she is Unget. But before the story is over, she finds that she has become a beautiful psyche as well. In a dizzying sequence of events, Psyche's ordeals are portrayed before O'Rourke. Finally, O'Rourke undertakes the fourth and last task of going to the underworld to bring Unget a box containing that beauty. But amidst the seductions and distractions of her friends and enemies, she succeeds this time in returning with this box of beauty. And then as Psyche and O'Rourke stand together before a stream, they become aware that the god is coming. No devouring god this time, but a great, immense presence of love. They never see him, but they sense something in their midst. Then they look down at the stream, and O'Rourke sees not one Psyche there, but two. She now has become Psyche, looking slightly different, distinctly herself, but radiantly beautiful. So at the end, O'Rourke does finally encounter God. God is a presence, not something, someone she can handle. And she's acquired a face, a real face, a beautiful face that's hers. And now, with Psyche's return, she's become radiantly beautiful. And there, with O'Rourke in the presence of the god, and now herself transformed, the novel closes. I think the story is a little bit hard to follow at the end. You might think it was hard to follow all along. Especially at the end, it's a little tricky. But what's clear is that O'Rourke's self-confrontation can't make her beautiful. That a gift has to be brought to her from another world. She can't do it for herself. And it is Psyche who is something very close to a god-human who is the one who can bring the beauty that will make O'Rourke herself beautiful. It depends on grace, a power beyond herself, for her to be transformed. That last note, though, on which the novel closes, is not some very clear seeing, some unambiguous encounter with God. It's O'Rourke's discovery that she's been transformed into a creature of beauty herself. The novel ends not with an encounter with a reality over there, but ends with her own experience of being remade, being given a face, becoming beautiful herself. The final religious experience of this book is an experience of the person, the self being transformed into a new kind of creature, and that God remaining present, but ever elusive. So hard to see, so hard to know. C.S. Lewis seems to have recognized here near the end of his life in a way and with a clarity he hadn't before that the life of faith is a journey into holy places as dark places. It's not always that way, but a great deal of it that way, and often the experiences that will teach us most are the experiences when God seems least clear, least present, least available to us. He portrays the difficulty of faith and the elusiveness of the gods and the frustrating ways they tantalize us. But he also describes powerfully the journey that leads to the gods. For someone like Psyche, it's a life of immediate trust, a kind of openness available from the moment she's born. For Arul, and probably for most of us, it's a long, baffling, confusing, occasionally blessed, sometimes wonderfully happy, but still circuitous and often self-deceiving journey in which we seek our proofs, work out our own self-pitying, prideful agendas, and often avoid at all costs the kind of painful self-confrontation that leads us finally to face ourselves and to face our God. And so at the end, he seems to have been aware of the heights and depths of human love and loss and the hunger for us to know and the confusion that can lead to, but above all of the powerful, transforming love that will work in and through all of our wayward, confusing ways to take us, hidden behind our veils, ugly as we may be, and to change us all into creatures of radiant beauty who will live forever. Thank you.
Have the house lights up a little more, please, or we can't see who wants to ask a question. I think we ought to have a brief question period, 10 minutes or so. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I think tip-off was 9:20, so we can try to be responsible about this. Thoughts and questions? Yes?
I'm curious as to the source from which you cited the poem.
Cited the poem. It's a poem of Lewis's called As the Ruin Falls. It's in the little volume of his poems. Yeah, there's a collection of his poetry. It's in there. Yeah, it's a wonderful poem. Anyone else? Could you follow the story? There's a lot of it, I know. Yes.
Have you ever read anything or had thoughts about possibly the link between the devouring and the loving being similar and transubstantiation of greed?
Well, that's interesting. The question was, have we ever thought of the connection between devouring and loving with the goddess and what happens in communion? You know, it was a commonplace of early pagan life, often that these Christians seemed to be cannibalistic, or at least carnivores. It's something that has caused a good deal of confusion along the way. One of the things I think is happening that makes this such a valuable book to read is Lewis is trying to get us to touch the wellsprings of all religion, including our own. And even though Unget is by what we have learned through the Christian faith an inadequate way of understanding the divine powers, what he's trying to say is there's something about that fundamental, visceral power that gives life that religion is trying to tap into. And what the fertility religions were, they weren't simple-minded or foolish. That was humanity trying to understand the nature of these powers and how to be in relation to them. And that was simply one step along the way of our coming to understand that. So I guess I would say my hunch is some of biting, that number, devouring, that notion of sacrifice, is on to something true. It just hasn't found its completion, its full expression, which awaited what happened in Christ. That would be my way of dealing with that. Any of you all find this too gloomy, a picture of Christian faith? I mean, after all, it's, well, it is Lent, so what do you expect? But it is a picture of struggle. And some might say, well, come on, C.S. Lewis, it's not quite that tough. Any of you all find yourselves resisting the kind of penetration of this vision? Yes.
I think that the relative scarcity, paucity of questions attests to the excellence of your presentation.
Well, thank you.
Let me just add one thing.
Yes.
I used to be irritated by the bumper sticker, Jesus is the answer. Nobody ever put a bumper sticker that says, what is the question? I think that's relevant.
Sure. You know, one thing I hope you all take away from this evening is a sense of the way that this great Christian writer honors the mystery of our life in God, whether we're at the beginning of the journey or wherever we are along the way, that the mystery and elusiveness of God is built into God's nature. In fact, one of the things I think he's saying so powerfully here is that it is God's love for us that keeps God so elusive. That if God were clearer, we would manipulate. We would make God part of our little world. One more possession, one more thing we can hold on to. And so it's God's very tantalizing nature that's part of his gift to us, that called us into the search into being true, authentic human beings. And learning that worst and most difficult task of all, which is to love other people, to come out of ourselves, so that we can love and know ourselves and know God. So to me, it's a very moving celebration of that kind of underside of the life of faith we often see as the problem and not the answer. And he's saying that very problematic area of struggle and confusion and God seem remote is the very area where God is most likely working in us and teaching us and leading us. And to me, that's, a lot of my life, that's great good news.
We are very much indebted to you. You have given us a great deal to think about, a fine and full evening, and I'm sure you've sent a great many of us back to the book.
Good, good, good.
That's the task. I'm pleased to announce that a year from now, March the 29th, 1993, the C.S. Lewis lecture will be delivered by Dr. William H. Willowen, who is Dean of the Chapel and Professor of Christian Ministry at Duke University. Duke has other colleagues. Thank you very much for coming. Good night.
Good night.